Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
During the 1980s, the GE "We Bring Good Things to Life" ads were ubiquitous. But so too was the presence of GE products in American lives. They made the refrigerators and cooking appliances in our homes, the airplane and locomotive engines that transported people and goods, the lights that illuminated the night, the plastics that surrounded us, and medical equipment that prolonged our lives. The company, founded by Thomas Edison in 1892, was a centerpiece of American technological innovation. And it was a place known for company loyalty. Once you got a job at GE, you could expect to work there until you retired.
But in 1981, a new day dawned at GE when Jack Welch became the CEO. The first of the modern CEO celebrities, Welch set out to make GE the most valuable company in the world. And he was able to consistently increase stock value and found himself lionized in the business press and by the business academic community. The way Welch achieved his objectives, his techniques of downsizing, of offshoring, reliance on finance and accounting tricks, ultimately led to the GE of today, a mere shadow of its former self. The Welch story is set out in compelling detail in a new book by New York Times reporter David Gellis entitled The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. Good morning, David, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Can you start with a little bit of background about Welch the man? Who was he when he took over at GE?
Well, Welch had just one job his whole life. He was a GE man from the time he graduated from a university program. And it's important to know that he was ferociously ambitious. He was intensely competitive. He was, by all accounts, enormously smart, often knowing more about the business line than the people actually running those businesses for him. And so he had this combination of bluster, aggression, ambition, and a real lust for trying to make GE a ferociously well-capitalized, highly competitive company. And he achieved exactly what he set out to do. My book acknowledges all that, but also takes a really, really critical look at the consequences of those actions. It's one thing to set out to essentially make a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs said, but you have to reckon with the consequences. And in the book, I explore a lot of the quote-unquote negative externalities, the consequences of this kind of a regime and what it actually did to our economy even today.
Can you give us the foundations of what GE was like in terms of product and corporate culture before Welch took over in 1981?
Absolutely. It's sort of hard to overstate just how influential GE was in the American economic story. Really, for much of the 20th century, it was the company that was essentially the bellwether. Where GE went, so went the country. Not only did it make, as you referenced in the introduction, the toasters, the radios, the televisions, the refrigerators, the washing machines, the jet engines, the power plants, that sort of was the stuff of our everyday lives, but it also had this reputation of being the corporation that other CEOs, other business leaders look to for guidance on how they ought to behave. So when they thought about how they need to structure their relationship with their employees, how they would interact with the government, GE was sort of the role model for other corporations. That all changed when Welch arrived. Rather than being this sort of benevolent corporation, one that made a point of paying its workers well and even paying its taxes, Welch came around and changed all of that in the most abrupt of fashion when he took over the company in 1981.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was the way you tie Welch's perspective on shareholder value, stockholder value, as sort of the sole objective of the corporation to the writings of Milton Friedman. I don't know if that was explicit or not in Welch's view, but it really does resonate, doesn't it?
It's important to note that things were changing when Welch took over, and inevitably, starting in 1981, the economy was going to change. GE was going to change. It's how he went about crafting that change. And as you say, the sources from which he was deriving his inspiration. And it's undoubtedly clear that Milton Friedman, the economist famously from the University of Chicago, who was active during this same time, was an important role model. It was a whole decade before Welch became CEO that Milton Friedman wrote in the New York Times Magazine that the social responsibility of a business is to increase its profits. But a whole decade transpired before, between Friedman putting that out there and Welch putting it into action. And I don't need to tell you two, there's a huge difference between theory and action. And what was largely theoretical in the age of Milton Friedman during the 1970s, when we still had stagflation, when the economy still wasn't growing, Welch put into action. And indeed, in his autobiography, there's this very telling phrase at the end of one of the chapters where he actually parrots Milton Friedman's words. And he essentially says the exact same thing, that in his view, the social responsibility of a business is to increase its profits, just like Milton Friedman said.
So as Welch began crafting change within GE, he started earning the nickname Neutron Jack. Neutron Jack. Explain a bit about his use of downsizing and its effects on the company's employee count and the importance of employee loyalty.
You said in the intro something that was so important, that when people joined GE in the 40s and 50s and 60s and even the 70s, they sort of could expect to have their job until they retired, unless they made a huge mistake, right? There was accountability, of course, but it was also a place where you didn't just expect to get fired because the numbers weren't looking good. Welch arrived in 1981 and came to the job with a fundamental belief that GE just employed too many people. And he, in the first couple of years, he set about, in this wave of mass layoffs and factory closures that fundamentally destabilized the American middle class. And it wasn't just shutting down factories and firing people for the heck of it. What he was doing was recognizing that labor was a cost. And if he wanted to make GE, the company, more profitable, well, one easy way to do that was to reduce its labor costs. And that meant firing people. And so it actually became this perverse incentive where if you fired people, your short-term numbers would look better. And you could actually improve your profitability by laying off people. But of course, what's the consequences of that for the livelihoods of those people, for the families of those people, for the communities where they live in? Well, we're now seeing 40 years later the long tail effects of Welch's decisions and so many other business leaders following suit and doing the exact same thing. And I don't need to tell you, we got a lot of problems out there. I trace many of those back to these sort of cold-eyed calculations that business leaders made. And when we look around and see unemployment and see towns like Schenectady, which was once a thriving city in upstate New York, it's just a shell of its former self. It's because men like Welch moved jobs out of Schenectady, fired those people, closed those factories, and occasionally moved the factories to Mexico, for example, but gave no thought to the long-term consequences of their actions.
One of the things that was interesting to me was the way that it seemed like Welch shrouded his sort of lack of loyal to employees with this concept of stack ranking. In other words, he rationalized it as being a beneficial thing. Can you talk a little about what stack ranking is?
Yeah, stack ranking was one of these sort of perverse management tools that he came up with. And here's how it works. If you have 100 employees, your mandate is thus. Take the 20% that are in the top, your 20% best employees, and there are the A players. The big middle, the 70%, those are the B players. And the bottom 10%, well, they're the C players, and you have to fire them every single year. And so it was this brutal mandate that ensured that no matter how well the company was doing, a lot of people were going to get fired anyway. And if this seems like an anachronism of sort of some distant economy in the 1980s, it's not. It's still with us today. Companies like Uber and WeWork are still using some of these same tactics in recent years. Microsoft famously used it for a long time when Steve Ballmer took over the company from Bill Gates. And this, I'm just trying to point out, is the legacy of Jack Welch. The things he set in motion in the 1980s are still with us today.
Let's look at another aspect of that, because Welch was also a pioneer in the use of outsourcing and offshoring. Can you explain his memorable quote about wishing that every plant could be on a barge?
This is, again, another way in which sort of he looked to rationalize what on the face of it are these really brutal labor practices. He wanted every factory to be on a barge so he could chase favorable exchange rates, cheap labor costs all around the world. But what, of course, is missing is that is any real relationship between the company and its employees. And when we look at this terribly transactional world that most professionals live in today, where, you know, there are surveys that routinely show that the majority of Americans have some low-grade fear that they might be fired at any given moment, that's the real legacy of Jack Welch. It was these kind of practices that made employment sort of contingent on the whim of your boss. But again, that just wasn't how it is. How it was historically in the United States. That wasn't the kind of environment that led the United States to emerge as the strongest economy in history in the 20th century and give rise to this thriving middle class that got us so far. But it's the world we live in today. And again, I argue over and over, it's at the root of so many of the deeper problems we've got in society as well.
So we see a world where Welch sort of really investigate offshoring. He moves appliance manufacturing to different countries. He is always looking for a way to, you know, minimize cost. The other thing that he does, though, which I thought was sort of, again, another thing that's really grown around corporate America, is he starts outsourcing any function he could, which limits the number of GE's employees and probably ends up with, you know, third-party contractors who pay less. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Without question. I mean, if you work at a big company, when you walk, the first person you see every day at your office probably doesn't work for you. Those men and women work in the security desk, the men and women in the cafeteria, the men and women cleaning up at the end of the day, all of those people in all likelihood work for third-party contractors who almost certainly enjoy substantially lower pay, substantially less desirable benefits, and substantially more fickle and contractual employment with their service provider. And that's Welch, still with us today. He was the one who in the 1980s said, don't run a cafeteria, let a food company do it. Don't print your own stuff, let a printing company do it. And there's some rationale to that, right? There are places where you need specialists to do the most specialized of jobs. But in the aggregate, what it resulted in was an economy where a smaller and smaller percentage of our nation's hardworking people were getting a meaningful slice of the wealth created by our nation's largest company. And that is the Jack Welch story writ large. When we talk about income inequality, this is not like the weather, right? This is not some abstract force that just happened. It's the product of individual choices by individuals who run our nation's biggest companies and their own priorities. And Welch was so influential, so powerful for so long, some two decades from 1981 to 2001, that essentially his worldview became adopted as the de facto law of the land in corporate America.
But what I think we see kind of coming about from this is that he wouldn't be in that role if he wasn't successful. And he was essentially living out Friedman's statement that the social responsibility of companies is to increase profits. What were they seeing? Where was he showing that success?
Did we lose you, David?
Yeah, we did. He just dropped off. The green light is off. We're going to go take a quick break.
Through his
I'm sorry, David, we lost you for a minute. Can
you still hear me?
Yes, we hear you now. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. It worked until it didn't. For most of those 20 years, he was able to keep GE's stock price going up, keep its revenues increasing with more than 1,000 mergers and acquisitions he did. But almost immediately upon retirement, GE fell from that perch and was never able to recover. And what became clear in the immediate aftermath of his retirement is that the ways in which he was creating so much shareholder value were simply unsustainable. He was doing it with this torrent of mergers and acquisitions. There was lots of suspicion that he was manipulating the earnings figures. And at the end of the day, it became clear that a lack of investment in research and development and these kind of financial shenanigans simply were not sustainable. And GE has never recovered. And in fact, last year, the current CEO announced somebody would be broken up into three parts for good.
One of the things he did, you talked about the wave of mergers and acquisitions and what one executive called a Pac-Man approach. One of the other things he did, of course, was really increase the use of GE capital. Talk a little bit about how he did that and how it created an ability to sort of hit earnings targets quarter after quarter.
I mean, GE, as you referenced, was an industrial company when he took over. This was a company that made things. But from the moment he took over, even before, I saw some memos that he wrote before he was actually CEO, he understood that this little unit called GE Capital really held the key to making GE the largest company in the world. And what he recognized, and there's again some truth to it, was that finance was about to explode, that the Wall Street and the finance industry in the United States was on the precipice of unparalleled expansion, and that if GE could be a major player in that, there was really no limit to what they could do. But what did that mean? It meant that over the years, GE got into more and more arcane lending businesses. They were financing auto loans in Thailand. They were buying up portfolios of commercial real estate debt. They were operating high interest credit cards. And by the end of GE Capital, this happened just after Welch retired, but it was the continuation of the strategy he had set in motion. His successor goes ahead and in 2005 buys one of the largest provider of subprime mortgages in the country just before the financial crisis. And that's the legacy of what happens when GE became not an industrial company, but a financial engineering company, a company that was essentially a large unregulated bank. And with all that money coursing through GE Capital, indeed, as you referenced, GE's accountants were able to essentially come up with what one analyst called earnings on demand, able to sort of meet or beat analyst expectations for almost 80 quarters in a row, an unprecedented run that when people started looking more closely, almost immediately realized something fishy was going on there. There's no way that a company can actually do that.
What has happened to GE since Welch left in 2001? Oops, sorry. What happened to GE since Welch left in 2001?
Welch's last day on the job was the Friday before September 11th, 2001. So again, things were going to change, and they were going to change dramatically. But the upshot is that his chosen successor, Jeff Immelt, ran the company for 16 years. And during that time, oversaw up and down roller coaster of a stock ride that ultimately left GE in a weaker place than where he inherited it. Jeff Immelt made a series of catastrophic mergers and acquisitions, essentially trying to repeat the Welch playbook of buying his way to profitability, buying his way to becoming a bigger company. He did go through a process of sort of winding down and starting to dismantle GE Capital, but that work still wasn't done after 15 years. And after Immelt retired in 2016 or 17, I believe, a succession of other CEOs sort of cycled through. And again, as I said, just last year, the current CEO, Larry Culp, said GE would be broken up into three standalone companies, essentially putting an end to this vision that Welch had, that GE could be sort of the company of all companies, one thing for everyone, and a bellwether for the rest of the U.S. economy. Those days are long gone, and before long, in just a matter of quarters, when these deals are finished, GE really, as we know it, will no longer exist.
One thing I'd like to cover, we only have a little bit of time left, and I've really got two more things I'd like to cover. One is sort of how Welch's influence went beyond GE and how former executives of GE were sought after to run other companies. Talk a little bit about how that worked and whether it was successful.
This was one of the things that really led me to write this book. As I started thinking about Welch's legacy, it became clear that not only was he influential sort of in the abstract, in the academic, but that his proteges had gone on to run dozens and dozens of other American companies and international companies as well. And really, in doing so, carried his legacy out there and helped make, again, his ideology the law of the land. And you look at some of those individual case studies, and they're not pretty pictures. Bob Nardelli, who was one of his potential successors, went on to run Home Depot and then Chrysler and had very rough 10 years at both of them. Jim McNerney, another one of his potential successors, was the CEO of Boeing. And a big part of the book I talk about was how GE executives, three men who worked directly for Welch, transformed Boeing and ultimately led Boeing to a place where it developed the flawed 737 MAX, which of course crashed tragically twice in 5 months. And the list goes on. In industries as diverse as technology, home and consumer goods, medical devices, the story sort of repeats itself ad infinitum. A CEO would be hired because the board thought that they would have the Midas touch because they worked with Welch. They give him a multi-million dollar pay package that ensures a gilded retirement no matter what happens. And yet, after a couple months or a couple quarters or maybe a couple years of employing Welch's strategy of downsizing and deal making and financialization, the company is usually in a worse place than it was when this man, as almost always men, took over, and they leave the company with a golden parachute, and the company has to go through the painful work of rebuilding yet again.
One of the important things about the book is the way you end it, which is where you talk about how American business can move beyond what you label as Welchism. Unfortunately, we run out of time, so I encourage people to get the book because the stories are remarkable, and it really does give you a lot of insight into why we are where we are as a society. Thank you for spending some time with us, David.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In the space of a few years, the prospect of canceling outstanding student loans has moved from the far-out fringe of higher education policy reforms to the center of the policy debate, and it could become actual executive branch policy in the very near future. Today, more than 44 million Americans hold a total of about $1.6 trillion in student debt, creating significant financial hardship that has reached crisis proportions even before the pandemic triggered massive job losses. Last week, Mountain Money explored the issue of student loan forgiveness with Beth Akers, a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, a preeminent center-right think tank. This week, we speak to someone who has a more liberal perspective, Marshall Steinbaum. Steinbaum is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah and a senior fellow in higher education finance with the Jane Family Institute. Marshall, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's great to be back. Thank you so much for having me.
You have a very strong background in the economics of higher education and the issue of student debt in particular. Can you share with the audience a bit about your background and what has drawn you to the topic?
Sure. I'm a labor economist by training, and I got into student debt around 2015 or 2016 when the labor market was still not great in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So the recession had been officially over for 5 years or more at that point, but there was still a lot of unemployment and in particular, very stagnant wages. So this whole idea that the labor market would return when the macroeconomy as a whole recovers was shown not to be true. At that point. And that is also the time at which kind of student debt came more to the fore as a policy problem. It had definitely been confined to the sort of higher education policy establishment before that. And it was around the mid-2010s that I would say more economists and policymakers from a sort of wider background kind of got into it. And I would count myself among them. So the way that I confronted the student loan data that I started analyzing back in 2015 was if everyone has so much student debt, why aren't they earning more? The theory of how much people make in the labor market that I was taught in graduate school was the one that Beth Hacker is more or less enunciated on this on this program last week, which is if you invest in your skills, then you get a raise in the labor market. And so in that sense, student debt is self-financing or self-repaying, because you'll take it on, you'll have a salary, you'll go to college, have a salary increase, and then you'll be able to easily pay it back, because that salary increase will be more than enough to make the loan payments affordable. And that just wasn't true in the data that I was seeing from the mid-2010s, and it's been decreasingly true since. And I think a big sort of philosophical or intellectual background to the student debt crisis is exactly that this whole edifice, the $1.6 trillion that you named earlier, is premised on that false assumption that this debt, people would take it on, they would have an earnings increase, and they'd be able to pay it back. And that just hasn't happened. And so the question now, basically, in the sort of Sturm und Drang about who's going to, or about student debt cancellation, is basically who's going to eat the consequences of that policy failure.
You know, at some level, though, we all think that when we sign up a document that says I'm borrowing money from you, that I should have to pay it back. And what is the underlying philosophical reason that we should transfer that obligation from the individual debtor to the taxpayers?
I basically don't buy that premise that this is about individual financing. The way I would conceptualize it is instead as follows. We used to provide higher education as a public good, more or less, in this country that was mostly paid for at the state level, though with some federal funding. And that whole edifice of self-financing student loans came to be a crutch for state-level disinvestment from the public good of higher education. So you're saying, why should we transfer the cost of higher education, in effect, from individuals to the state? And the question I would ask back to you is, why did we transfer the cost of higher education from the state onto the shoulders of individuals? And the answer is, again, at a sort of intellectual philosophical level, that we decided it was the case that higher education is mostly a private good, that this is something that people invest in to improve their earnings, and therefore they can pay it back. So why should the state intervene, to use the loaded language of, kind of neoliberal policymaking, in order to pay for higher education when individuals can do that perfectly well themselves? And then what you get is the student loan system is necessary. And I thought Beth enunciated this point quite well, so quite straightforwardly, when she was on your program. You know, it's not true that any bank will just issue a loan to an 18-year-old with no credit and no earnings to pay for a college degree. So you do need the state to, what in the kind of technical lingo would be called, to complete the capital market. That is to say, there's not going to be bank lending forthcoming unless the government backstops it. And the government wants people to go to college. So that idea, the government wants people to go to college, is kind of at odds with this idea that higher education is a private good. But leaving that aside, the role for the state is basically to guarantee that there's a capital market available so that people can take out loans to pay for their education and then eventually repay out of their increased earnings. We've had this now, you know, basically 15-year process by which higher education finance has become more and more solely federal. So it used to be the government or the federal government backstop private lenders so that there would be a capital market. That didn't work for a variety of reasons. It was basically taken in-house during the Great Recession. During the Great Recession, the financial crisis. And so we've kind of basically that idea that the government's job is to backstop private lenders, to me, it represents the sort of pinnacle of neoliberal higher education finance policy. And ever since then, we've kind of been trying ineffectually to bail out the rickety boat that is the fact that that whole system just doesn't work. People's earnings don't go up. Therefore, they can't repay the loans. Therefore, the private lenders come begging the government for a bailout. Therefore, we put the loans on the government's balance sheet. And then we sort of implement these post hoc policy fixes like income driven repayment, which I think we'll get to in a moment, so I won't go too much farther now.
So essentially, this is baked into the system, the fact that people can't make this work. Was this known at the beginning? You know, I'd like to think that, you know, for all good and intents, we thought this could work, or did we, or did we find out things we didn't know and made assumptions?
Well, we definitely made assumptions. You're asking a question that sort of verges on the motivations behind the policy changes. So a big, before I can answer the question is, did we know this from the beginning, is when's the beginning? Because the history of higher education policy is complicated and goes back a long time. I would date the beginning to sometime between the Higher Education Act of 1965 and the Higher Education Act of 1972, or the renewal of the Higher Education Act of 1965 in 1972. And between those two laws, you have a kind of revolution in basically what I was talking about earlier, this idea that higher education is a private good, individuals should take out loans to pay for it, as opposed to the government funding universities so everyone who's qualified, who meets academic standards, could go for free. Basically, that was the pre 1972 mindset. And I don't think so. So yes, we made false assumptions. The big one being going to college causes your earnings to go up, and therefore you can repay loans. I don't have to. I have a fairly cynical interpretation of the motive there. I think if you look at why those policy changes were put in place when they were, it was a lot about the campus unrest of the 1960s, that these, you know, sort of free higher education, where it's heavily funded by state governments, that gives rise to the sort of campus unrest where, you know, the view of policymakers was students are irresponsible. They have time to go protest. They don't have to worry about their jobs. They don't have to worry about repaying their loans. We need to exert some discipline here. And the way to exert discipline is by loading students up with debt. And this idea that, oh, they'll be able to repay it because their earnings will go up, is kind of a convenient ex post fiction to validate what I would consider to be a reactionary political evolution in that late 60s backlash to the campus unrest.
You know, the current policy proposals that are being floated range between a $10,000 forgiveness and a $50,000 forgiveness. Let's talk a little bit about what kind of a policy you would advocate, and then we'll sort of explore what some of the implications of that are.
Well, I have, so might as well say this up front, I have advocated for a total student debt cancellation, because I think we're basically having a futile argument if we're arguing about amounts, because I don't think very much, if any, of the outstanding student debt is going to be paid back at all. And I don't think that this question of the limitation on the cancellation amounts is a very good way of distinguishing between the debt that's going to be paid back at all and the debt that's not going to be paid back at all. So to me, the question is just, are we going to cancel it today? Are we going to cancel it in 15 years? Are we going to cancel it in 25 years after people's lives have been ruined? I would go so far as to say, by having carried it all that time, before the government kind of gets it into its thick head that these loans are bad debt and they're not going to be paid back. I think it was basically, it's a policy experiment that did not succeed and should be abandoned. I also think that there's lots of other things that have to happen in higher education finance. I think one criticism of the idea of a blanket cancellation that has some merit is, aren't people just going to keep taking out debt loans tomorrow if we cancel the debt today? And I do worry about that. The higher education, the political economy of higher education in this country generates $100 billion of non-repayable student debt every single year. And there's no reason why the mere fact of canceling the debt that's outstanding would cause higher education institutions to radically shift their business model back to one that is much more of a public good, where there's constraints on the cost of college and constraints on the degrees that they're offering. A big source of the student debt problem is that in reaction to the withdrawal of state aid for higher education, institutions become much more privatized. Even the ones that are formally public are looking for revenue. That's what they're doing. So for one thing, they're trying to increase the undergraduate tuition to as much as the students can bear, and that hinges heavily on the loan limits that the federal government places on student debt. So there's good evidence that basically tuition payments by students react to increases in federal student loan limits. And then they also proliferate graduate degrees, which, as Beth Akers alluded to, there's no limit on the amount of debt that you can take out for that. So it becomes basically a cash cow for institutions to proliferate terminal master's degrees that are very expensive, that have seemingly a very strong sort of professional flavor to them, like this, getting this degree will help you get a job. And what that that amounts to is basically, if anything, shifting the cost of job training from employers to students. So point is, there's sort of now a tendency to take advantage of the open-handedness of the federal student loan program baked into the DNA of neoliberalized universities. And so canceling student debt will not by itself solve that problem. On the other hand, I would like to offer a rebuttal to one thing that Beth said in this respect, which is that I think canceling student debt helps get us to a world where higher education is re-engineered. It doesn't impede that. So this idea that, oh, if we just cancel the debt today, actually that is going to encourage people to take on more debt in institutions to become more neoliberalized and rack up tuition because everyone's just going to think, oh, it's a free lunch. I don't think that's an accurate analysis of the political landscape around higher education policy. There's a reason why higher education institutions and their lobbying organizations are opposed to student debt cancellation, which is that line that they have used for decades now to justify increasing tuition and the proliferation of master's degrees and the general neoliberalization of the institution is that a higher college degree pays off or a master's degree pays off. And so this idea that there's $1.6 trillion of debt out there that's not going to be repaid is just a stark fact that belies that entire generation of higher education administration. And I don't think they want the world to acknowledge that. So if the government did cancel the $1.6 trillion, recognize that it's bad debt, I think what the institutions are greatly afraid of is Congress thinking, wait, so we just canceled the $1.6 trillion, but we're still generating $100 billion of new debt every single year to pay for this thing that we're probably also going to have to cancel. You know, what's going on here? Why are the institutions not generating the so-called return on investment that they've been promising?
The part of the student loan repayment, part of an option that has been put out is an income-driven repayment, which seems like it starts to address the ability for, you know, it caps the loan payments based on a percentage of income. So isn't this a way to be able to perhaps address those whose income hasn't risen?
It's a good idea, but unfortunately, we've been trying it for a decade and it hasn't worked. In fact, more than a decade. I mean, those programs pre-exist the 2010s, but they were radically increased around the time I got into the higher education policy world. So they were expanded in 2015, 2016 to apply to more students. And the fact is, just by its nature, the structure of the program is unadministrable. The way it works is you reduce your loan payments to a set percentage of your so-called discretionary income. And then if you have any debt still outstanding, so that reduces your monthly payments so that you're not making the same amortization schedule as you would on a traditional student loan. So let's say it takes 10 years to pay off a traditional student loan. You go into IDR, reduce your monthly payments. The repayment period goes out to 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. And then it has this backstop where if you haven't repaid all your debt by a certain date, and the different programs are different about how long you have to be in them, then you have all your student debt canceled. The problem with that structure is that it requires keeping track of the repayment history of students looking backward. And that is something that the Federal Department of Education has shown repeatedly it's basically unable to do. And so that's one big problem is we have to maintain this repayment record. You know, there's multiple student loan servicers. They've been told that it's not their responsibility to keep repayment records for students for loans or students. I don't even know if it's at the borrower level, at the loan level. It's probably at the loan level that were serviced by a servicer before they got the loan. So these loans could have been passed around between servicers throughout their lifetime. And there's basically no way. We just don't know. So a lot of what you're seeing now from the Biden administration is basically cleaning up the mess of not knowing what people's repayment record is and saying, you know, actually, the structure of the program says we have to keep track of this, but we're just going to act as though we don't and give you a cancellation without knowing for sure that you did all the things, that you dotted all the I's and crossed the T's. And I support that. I think that's correct. It was a bad policy. That is a humane solution to it. But that it's weird to then say, oh, well, we're cleaning up this entire mess. Let's keep that same policy that created the mess in place. And that's going to be our solution. And then we're going to clean up that mess in 10 years. That's basically the same as student debt cancellation. So except it keeps people in limbo all this time and is much more of an administrative lift. The other piece, so the one reason why IDR hasn't worked is this backward looking record of payments. The other reason it hasn't worked is because it requires borrowers to attest their income to the Department of Education. So the Department of Education doesn't know borrowers' income and can't know that of its own accord. That is to say, the IRS cannot tell the Department of Education what people are earning and release tax records to them. So they have to, the education basically has to get individuals to repeatedly tell them what their earnings are. So if you're in IDR, you have to re-certify, as the term, your earnings every year to set what your payments are going to be for the coming year. That is to say, okay, well, you earned this, you earned, you know, $50,000 or whatever last year, and your loan amount would be whatever per month that's above the percentage of your discretionary income that you're supposed to pay. So we adjust it downward to something else. Then next year, we kind of go through this rigmarole again. That turns out to be a very administratively burdensome process. So lots of people fall out of IDR on that sort of annual recertification. And if you fall out of IDR, what happens is the balance, that the unpaid balance that accumulated, that is to say the payments that you didn't make because you had payments that were below what you would need for the 10-year schedule, those get capitalized into the balance of the loan. So you fall out of IDR because you're doing recertify your income. Suddenly your loan balance is a lot higher than it was. And then the magic of compound interest kicks in. So the loan balance can, mount up and up from there. So there's more and more people. I mean, my research shows this very clearly. More and more people who, it seems, I guess I don't know for certain that they are enrolled in IDR, but I suspect what I'm seeing here is people who are enrolled in IDR basically having increasing loan balances over time, especially those who were most detrimentally affected by the Great Recession. So IDR basically just becomes this wait 20 or 25 years until cancellation program, not a, you know, kind of make your payments affordable and you'll be able to eventually repay. And that's why I'm saying there's really no difference between student debt cancellation and IDR.
Marshall, before we go, you constantly hear a couple of reactions to proposals for student loan cancellation. I call them, it's almost the hydra of it's regressive, which means the benefits are going to go to doctors and lawyers, and it creates moral hazard. Can we just quickly sort of take a shot at those two? I could just see you getting ready.
I'll take the second one first, moral hazard, because I think this is really bespeaks the values that are laden in a lot of the coverage and policy analysis of this. What moral hazard, what people usually mean by that is that students or borrowers would be told, oh, you don't have to repay your debt, you should take out more. To me, we already have tons of moral hazard in the system, and it is on the part of higher education institutions. The government holds this open handout of federal student loans that tells the institutions they can charge as much tuition as they want. They can proliferate master's degrees as much as they want. That tells state legislatures they can cut funding for public higher education institutions because it doesn't matter. The institutions will still be able to survive. It's not like cutting funding from the state legislature is going to cause the university to go out of existence. They'll just re-engineer themselves to take advantage of the federal student loan program. That's the moral hazard that very much exists now. And as we were discussing earlier, I would hope that student debt cancellation would take a major step towards remedying it, which is giving some institutional accountability and some accountability for policymakers. I don't think, to me, the last people who are at a moral fault for the student debt crisis are the borrowers. That is the least powerful people in this entire system, the people who are know least about how the higher education finance system works. It's kind of bizarre to say, oh, it's your fault that we have all these problems and not the people who actually have their hands on the levers of power. On the matter of regressivity, so it's true that if you look at the cross-section of student borrowers, the total balance on student loans correlates positively with income. That doesn't mean that student debt cancellation is regressive. The way we measure regressivity is as in relation to your sort of pre-policy income. So, for example, Social Security is widely considered to be a progressive program, correctly so. It still gives more money to people who have higher incomes or had higher incomes during their working lives because it is a pretty weakly increasing function of your labor income during your lifetime, but it's still an increasing function. But it is a huge benefit to poorer retirees who would otherwise be in poverty. And it's basically, you know, not that significant for higher income retirees who also have savings and assets and so on. So that makes Social Security rightly a progressive program, notwithstanding the fact that higher income people get more dollars. That's basically the same fact for student debt cancellation. So if you think Social Security is progressive, you should think student debt cancellation is progressive.
We've been speaking with Marshall Steinbaum. He's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Utah and a senior fellow in higher education finance with the Jane Family Institute. Marshall, thank you for sharing time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.